Welcome to another episode of the Inner Man Show. I'm your host, Dylan Eckes. Tonight, I am joined with my good friend, Rod Willier. Shane couldn't make it tonight. He had some scheduling issues with work. No harm, no foul, though. He'll be back next week. But Rod, you and I, you just finished telling me that you finished all of your paperwork and all of your homework for the rest of the semester.
Yeah, like huge weight off the shoulders.
With like 3 weeks left too.
Yeah.
2 weeks left.
2 weeks left and I'm done every single thing I need to get done. Hopefully what I put in keeps me on the presidential role, which I mean, will be really good since my marks have gradually gone
what
up.
What does that mean semester. For you at Mesa College?
Presidential role is 3.5 GPA and higher out of four. So roughly breaks down to like an 85-86%.
Congratulations, man. That's awesome. So, and you're on it right now?
Right now with the marks I have,
yeah.
With like not official marks, unofficial marks, I am, right, which will be good. I won't know that until probably December 18th, 19th, or whenever our marks come out.
That's awesome, man. Good for you. Good for you. Well, I want to thank you again because you've lined up another amazing guest for our podcast tonight. Someone I grew up watching when it comes to football. So why don't you do the honors and introduce our guests this evening?
Yeah, no problem. Hey, everyone. Our next guest on the Inner Man Project show is a friend of my family. I have heard this man speak on staying in school, not doing drugs, not drinking a lot of alcohol, resiliency, and working hard to achieve your goals. I've known this man for about 30 years. He has been a guest of my trailer in the Sucker Creek First Nation Reserve in Alberta. I have hunted with him, played basketball against him when I was in junior high. He has shared many stories about his career and life. This man is a CFL alumni, was a defensive end and linebacker, played 13 seasons with the Edmonton Eskimos, now known as the Edmonton Elks. He holds several tackling records, won a Grey Cup in 1993 with the Eskimos. Him and his father are the only father-son duo on the Grey Cup. Currently works with youth in the Edmonton area. Ladies and gentlemen, the powerful, resilient number 43, Jed Roberts.
Thank you very much. That was really nice. I think I'll go just hanging out, man. I've got nothing else to do, man. That's the best introduction I think I've ever had.
Jed, thanks for doing this, man. Before we get started, why don't you give the listeners who aren't familiar with the CFL or much about sports for that matter, can you give the listeners a little background of who you are, some of the adversities you faced through professional sports as a kid, that sort of thing, and how you became an absolute unit for the Edmonton Elks?
Well, okay, so I guess I'd have to start way back when my dad is from Iowa. He grew up in Des Moines. His parents were from Iowa as well. So my grandfather, his dad, married a woman named Annabelle. I called her Granabelle. She was First Nations and she was adopted, but she didn't know anything about her background. And so my dad resonated really deeply with my dad. Not so much with me because I wasn't, my dad and my mom split up. Well, my mom and my dad met in university. My dad played football, basketball, and ran track for Kansas University. And my dad used to sit in the back of the bus when he was playing basketball for KU. And he used to sit in the back of the bus with this guy named Pete. And Pete was from Topeka. And Pete was telling my dad about this girl that he used to date in high school that he thought, my dad should maybe consider dating her because Pete was dating somebody else at that time. And so Pete introduced my dad and my mom to each other. Long story short, my dad and my mom got married. My dad went to Ottawa, played football for the Ottawa Rough Riders, played 7 years, won two Grey Cups in 68 and 69. And then my mom and dad split up after, I think it was 72, 73. And my mom took myself and my two sisters and we moved to from Ottawa to Tennessee, in Eastern Tennessee, to move in with her parents. And then I wouldn't see my dad except for during summer times in Ottawa when he was working for the Métis Association of Ontario. Then he worked for Indian Affairs. I did a lot of consulting work. He worked with Congress of Aboriginal Peoples. So I would only see him in the summer times, right? So I wasn't raised Native or anything like that. I never really had a lot of contact with them unless we were going out to Métis settlements and like out by, there used to be a big Métis gathering we'd go to every summer in not far from, it's called White River. I don't know if you guys know where that is, between Sudbury and Thunder Bay. just out there in the sticks, man. There's nothing to do out there but fish. It's glorious. But long story short, my mom and my my sisters and I, we moved from Tennessee out to Colorado. And then while I was in Colorado in high school, my mom started dating Pete again. So my stepdad introduced my dad to my mom, and then my mom got married to my stepdad after that. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. That was a long way to that joke. It was kind of a buildup, and I hope I didn't disappoint you guys. But, I was also born with a nerve defect in both ears. I have a bilateral nerve defect, which basically means if my wife's really angry at me, I can just figure it out, you know. If I need to concentrate on things, I can turn my hearing aids off. So it's a lot of things that I can do that I didn't look at as a good thing when I was a kid. I had a really difficult time with it. In fact, I only wore one hearing aid until I moved to Edmonton in 1990. My first year with the Eskimos was in 1990. I went on to play 13 wonderful years here in the community. My dad kind of gave me a heads up when I moved into Edmonton. He said, listen, Edmonton's a community-owned team. They cherish the team and they embrace the players. The players stay there year round, and you know, they don't do that as much anymore now with the advent of the 1 year contracts. But, back when I played, we all signed long-term contracts. We didn't make a lot of money, but we were working in the off season. So that was supplementing our CFL income and all that. I can remember the entire offensive line, they all paid off their houses while they were playing. So, that's not bad. You know, we weren't making a ton of money, but you know, the money that we made. My dad always used to say to me, when you go in to renegotiate your contracts, don't ask for more money. Just ask for more of what you're getting, you know, and I never knew what that meant until I was in my 9th or 10th year and I was making minimum. And people was like, you're crazy. You can make more money going someplace else. And I'm like, why would I want to leave Edmonton? They're going to take care of me here. And that's true. You know, like I've done a lot of different things here in the community. Right now, I find myself in the same field that I was working in. As a part-time job outside of football when the end of my career was kind of coming on, which was working with at-risk youth in a residential treatment type setting. And, you know, it's an eye-opening situation. Unfortunately, there's demand for it. You know, there's lots of kids out there with parents that just for whatever reason can't seem to, you know, make it work. And, you know, somebody's got to step in and take care of those kids. And that's something that's really been near and dear to my heart for 30 years now. I've been doing it for a long time. I started out working in corrections and then sort of migrated over to the kids end of it. I worked at AYOC for a bit, but corrections and, you know, jail is really depressing. And I'm not saying that it's any walk in the park working in the group home, but at least with these kids, you feel like there's a chance that they could, you know, figure it out and do some pretty amazing things. And I've seen things like the things I've seen in this field have by far trumped anything I ever saw on the football field. And that's lots of pretty cool things, you know. Won a Grey Cup in 93, participated in 4 Grey Cups. And, you know, that's a pretty cool feeling, but it's a game, right? We were getting paid really well to play a game, and it was something we were doing as kids. So I never really lost sight of that. My dad was always like, listen, you know, if you give back to that community, the rewards you reap will be unbelievable. I can't even describe to you how, and Rod, you touched on it, man. Like when I went up north to Sucker City and mm-hmm. you know, we were out in the bush, you know, calling moose and, you know, eating dry meat. And you know, it's just, you know, people don't understand, you know, like what it's like up there. So, and that's not something I would have had a chance to do if I would have had it in my head that I wanted to follow the money or whatever. I mean, it's not like people were waving money at me, but you know, there's more important things in life, you know. And my dad used to say, you know, you don't want to collect money, you want to collect friends. And, you know, and that's the relationship I had with your dad, Rod. Like, we still keep in touch today. And, you know, that's what life's about. So I'm really glad you guys asked me to come on today. I'm sorry, I'm rambling a little bit. So let me get back.
No worries. You're definitely not rambling. This is a fantastic conversation. And we are, you know, grateful for you being here. Rod, you had a couple of things that you wanted to touch on for sure.
Yeah, I know when you said, like, you were only in the summer up in Ottawa with your dad, right, doing the Métis settlements, but usually you spent most of the time back in Tennessee?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So growing up in Tennessee, I guess, more or less, you've probably seen your fair share of racism. I'm assuming you've had some racism slurs thrown your way on the football field and through college and everything like that. I also know you were a big supporter of Chuba Hubbard. That came up through the ranks in the St. Albert, I want to say he played for, if I'm, or Sherwood Park, something like that. Yeah. And then he went off to college in the States, and now he's running back for the Carolina Panthers. Could you give any advice on to kids growing up that have a racial background to how to deal with the racism coming from fans, coaches, teammates?
Yeah, I guess refs. You know, race, that's a tricky one, because it's always something that people will do. Like, for example, when you're playing football, I guess, I don't know what the hockey equivalent of this would be, maybe in a scrum along the boards or something, right? If you're down in the bottom of a pile, that's the most common denominator, right? So people are going to go to the thing that they think is going to get under your skin, you know, and it's just, I've heard the most horrible things, you know, even though I don't have my hearing aids on, I can read lips really well. So mm-hmm. I see what people say. And I remember one game we were in Montreal, and there was a guy yabbering at me. And then at the very end of the game, I walked up to him. I said, man, you just spent the last hour talking trash to a deaf man. So I just use my sense of humor. And that's what I tell kids. I mean, listen, you know, life's too short. Don't take advice from somebody. Like, don't take criticism from someone you would never go to advice for. You know what I mean? So it's just a situation where people have, maybe their own preconceived biases and notions about, or maybe they were taught things a certain way. And, you know, I think people have to take responsibility for the things they do and they say, and that's certainly true. But I also think that sometimes you have to consider background when you're hearing things like that. You know, a lot of times when you're hearing kids say things like that, you're probably hearing what their parents talk about at home, right? So,
yeah.
And that's something that when I was younger, my dad kind of explained to me, and that's just so, it's just a powerful testament to how important parenting is. You know, when you have someone there to be able to keep things in perspective for you and put things in context. I know, Rod, with your dad was really brilliant at that, you know, talking about, you know, maybe there's a deeper issue. Maybe there's a more like an underlying, maybe a systemic thing going on there, that as opposed to you and that one in the person. Mm-hmm. I firmly believe that when you get into the room with someone, we all have more in common with each other than people would like, you know, certain institutions and certain, you know, entities would lead us to believe or have us believe, you know. I don't think that we're as polarized or as different as people would like us to believe. I think that we have a lot more in common. I firmly believe that. I've broken bread with people from all over the world. And, you know, at the end of the day, we all smile the same. We all want the same things for our kids. And racism is a tough one, right? It's more about power. You know, it's about who's got it, who wants it, and who doesn't have it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stuff, and I think that's what a lot of people get touchy about, like being a beneficiary of a system that gives them a certain amount of autonomy. You know, I might not get pulled over as quickly as somebody else might, you know, if I look a certain way. Mm-hmm. And that's real, you know, and you can't deny that. And I think sometimes people get their back up, but I also think people get their back up for good reason, you know, because maybe those people don't honestly feel that way, you know. Mm-hmm. So we all need to talk more, you know, and not instead of shouting at each other, let's listen, you know. And I think that's something that's lost in today's world. And you know, you can learn a lot if you just quit yelling and started listening, you know. Totally. I think that's why I'm glad you guys brought me on tonight, you know. And I don't get a chance to talk about this stuff very often. And I think, you know, in today's society, different than when I was younger and 30 years ago coming into the CFO, we didn't talk about these things. You know, mental health, that's not something we talked about. We didn't share these things with each other, especially not men, you know. So times change, things change, you know. Things are always going to be tough, you know. It's never going to be easy. Anything worth having is worth fighting for, you know. And then sometimes you got to fight through some pretty crappy things, like people saying things to you, know, they're going to get under your skin, and you know how you react to that says a lot about who you are and about the upbringing that you got. So that's my advice for kids, is just to consider the source and consider the situation and scenario and the context, and you know, choose your words carefully, you know, because what you say sometimes can come back to haunt you, especially in today's day and age. I remember when I was a kid, I didn't have to worry about the internet, didn't have to worry about cell phones being pointed at me. You know, those things can be held against you, you know. And
Even now,
whatever we're doing online video here, anything we say or do, it's collected and disseminated later at a later date by someone, right? And they'll form opinions about you based on what you say and how you react to certain situations. And You know, really today more than ever, consider your words and consider the gravity of your actions, because everything's being recorded. You know, when we were kids, we ran around in the bushes and we got hit in the face with the bush. It wasn't a vine. It wasn't a snap. It wasn't a, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Nobody even saw it happen. So it's like, did it really happen? You know,
I love it.
You got proof, right? So yeah, that's my advice.
Jed, you talked about growing up, you know, not in touch with your indigenous roots. When did that start becoming a part of your life in terms of, you know, getting in touch with your indigenous culture, understanding your heritage, understanding your background and who?
You know, it was when I moved to Edmonton and my dad, we had some, my dad told me to call this lady when I first moved to Edmonton. It was a woman that was oddly enough, an Ottawa Rough Riders cheerleader when he was playing for Ottawa.
Okay.
And her name is Louise Hayes. And I actually just talked to her yesterday. She's like my second mom. And she was the personal secretary to Joe Clark when he was prime minister of Canada. And Louise has more contacts than anyone I know, you know, and she actually got her honorary doctorate from the University of Alberta about 10 years ago, which I attended, which was really cool. But it's only because, she had such good connections and such good relationships with people. She told me to go to Native Counseling Services of Alberta in 1991 or 92. And my dad said, you know, you need to get in and make some connections with the indigenous community there, and they will embrace you. And just like what we were talking before the show, Rod, about how, you know, if you're in the field, you're working in social services and kids look out and they see someone that looks like them, you know, like when they see you, they see potentially what they could be in 10, 15, 20 years, right?
Yeah.
I'm not going to date you, but, you know.
Yeah, no worries.
they want to be able to see somebody willing to come in, you know. And I remember people used to ask me at Stan Daniels. I worked at Stan Daniels. It was the jail, right? And the guys there used to say, what are you doing here, man? You play for the Eskimos. Like, why do you work here? Like, I wasn't making that much money. I was making like $12 an hour or something, right? And I'm like, well, why not? You know, like I just want to, you know, see what it's all about. Right. And so that's kind of where I made my first sweat. I think the elder that we had there, Frank, he took me to my first sweat, and I didn't know what a sweat was. You know, I didn't know what, you know, I didn't know what it was for, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and it was daunting because I can't wear hearing aids. Right. So I'm in there kind of, you know, it's dark. I can't hear. So I'm basically Helen Keller at this point. So I'm hot. Thankfully, the scapio took pity on me. He gave me some water, but, you know, I was before I fainted. But you know what? I mean, everything's a learning opportunity. So, and I didn't get a lot of the connections I had with my dad in the summertime. They were so brief. You know, I just kind of took his lead. And that's one thing that he told me was just apply here, see where it takes you. And I was like, well, why? And I always wanted to know why. He's like, just let it unfold, man. You're like, the community will embrace you like nothing else. And and that's exactly what happened. You know, the more I went out there, the more I got my name out there, the more I showed willingness to do some of the things and go. Like, there were guys on the team that didn't want to go on the reserve because it terrified them, right? They just didn't understand. Like, one of the things that used to drive them crazy is like, they would go on the reserve and they start talking and everybody would just be kind of looking around and not really paying attention. They were paying attention. They just were doing it in their own way, right? Like, maybe the kids would walk out and then come back in or whatever. But, you know, I mean, it's just a different world, man, you know? And, you know, when I went up north, I got to go all the way up to Tuktoyaktuk and Inuvik and some places up there. And my dad warned me. He said, listen, man, it's just totally different. Everybody depends on each other up there, right? And that's something that we've lost as a society, right? And some of the things that I was taught working at Stan Daniels and going out to the reserves and stuff like that, these are things that are so fundamentally simple, but yet profound and right. You know what I mean? And that's something that I think we've lost in society. And he was very careful in telling me that you need to make yourself willing to do some of the things that some of your teammates won't, and go some of the places that they don't feel comfortable going, because if you don't go, who's going to go, you know? But I was like, well, how are they going to receive me? You know? And he's like, well, they'll receive you on your own merits. If you're authentic, they'll sense that, you know?
Yeah. We always talk about being the change that we want to see in our community. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I remember going out to Enoch and meeting Joe Cardinal. I don't know if you remember him or if his name rings a bell. I don't know if it was Enoch or if it was, anyway, he was a D-Day. And I remember sitting at his table. I think it was at the end of my career, about 2001, 2002. I think he passed on since, but I remember listening to him tell the stories about being in Bastogne. I think it was when the Germans were bombing. I don't know if you've ever seen Band of Brothers. He was there, you know, he saw the whole, he was, and he said, cause Band of Brothers was really popular there. And I was talking about it. He was like, listen, kid, you don't know, like that, what they showed there was like maybe 5% of what it was really like. He says, you don't understand. Like, and we did that for, he told me how long they had done it. And I just sat there with my jaw open, right? And I just kept my mouth shut. And I just listened to this old man talk for like 3 hours. And everybody else at the table was just completely shocked, you know, that this guy was willing to go over there and fight for a country that wouldn't even let him walk into a liquor store or walk into a bar or even have, you know, voting rights or anything like that. So, and that was during his generation, all that stuff happened, right? So one of the biggest pieces of advice my dad gave me was to just listen to the old ones talk, you know, and let them. And he says, sometimes they're going to take a while to get there, but they always get there, you know, in terms of like the lesson. Sometimes you're not even going to see the lesson until years later when something happened. You're going to be like, that's what he was talking about, right?
So, yeah.
You know, and that's something he said, you really got to learn to like look out for that, because a lot of that is, it's lost. You know, we don't get those. We're such a consumable society. We're such a society of like, we want things now.
Yeah.
And the best things in life don't happen right now. You know, the best things in life happen, you know, years down the road when your kids and your grandkids and all that other stuff, but people want things so quickly. But yeah, my dad was always a big proponent of getting out and making sure that I did as much as I could with the kids around on the reserves around the city. And he made it a point to say, listen, if you get an invitation to go up north, up north to me seemed like Fort McMurray. And he's like, no, I'm talking about way up to Yellowknife and all those places. And he says, it's a different world up there. And you wouldn't even believe that you'd find that in Canada. Mm-hmm. You know, it's pretty crazy that you can see places like, you know, that still exist where, you know, if you go, you know, 20 kilometers outside the city, you're taking your life in your hands, right? Because there's nothing out there. There's no fences. There's no hydro. There's nothing, you know? So it's only the people that know how to live on the land that survive out there. So
totally. Pretty totally.
Cool. I know, like when we were before the show started, we were talking about how I took my long journey to get where I wanted to go. I know when I was growing up, I had my own expectations of what I wanted to do with my own life. And at the time, my career path that I'm doing now, it was not even in the cards. I was more focused on, like most kids in High Prairie, most kids like in Canada, I was playing sports. So first off, I was a hockey player. Every kid's dream is to make the show. Having a realistic father and knowing the odds of a Canadian boy even back then. So my draft year would have been 2000. So by 2000, I think the possibilities of a Canadian boy getting drafted was like 2.2% or 1.2% of the whole NHL. And that's even just to get drafted. That's not even including making it to the show. That's just get to AHL teams. Having realistic parents, I guess, instead of not the parents that are like, hey, you can be whatever you want to be. It doesn't matter. I pass that. I've been passing that down to my daughter and my kids. And I guess my thing is the experiences in my life, and I guess the experiences in your life, how have your experience helped you with your career now as a youth worker?
Well, a lot of it had to do with like the relationship dynamics between, you know, at home. And I think that's where everything starts, right? Like, you know, our first memories are of like our parents, like the first expressions, like the first person looking at you. I mean, most people in terms of like that have parents at home, like some people don't have that or aren't fortunate enough to have that. But, you know, I looked at my mom and dad, you know, what was their relationship like? Well, it wasn't ideal, right? You know, my dad left and the only time I saw him was in the summer times. And you know, and that hurt. It was tough to deal with that. I didn't really understand. There were some things that happened to me when I was a kid, you know, like when I was first going to school in Ottawa, I was, well, I'll give you the long version. I'll give you the short version. I had to take a cab to school because I was very difficult to kind of manage behavioral wise because I couldn't talk and I couldn't hear, but I was old enough and I was aware. And my mom had two little girls to raise along with me while my dad worked, and my mom didn't have the car. My dad did. So my parents, in their infinite wisdom, decided to put me in a cab and take me to a school. Like, that the cab would take me to school. It was the only school that would take me with my behavioral issues and stuff and my inability to talk and all that. It was just like they put me in. It was like a kindergarten type of thing. Long story short, the cabbie that was driving me there was sexually assaulting me every day. And it was happening, I think it was probably for 6 to 8 months. And I remember, like, even now, like, I have nightmares of my mom dragging me from the front door to the cab, and the cab driver smiling, you know? And so what he would do is, after school, he would pick me up, and then he would drive over, and him and a friend would, you know, do what they were doing. And then he would take me home. And I had no way of communicating that to my mother. All I did was cry. And my mom thought I was just really upset about going to school. I mean, it was, mm-hmm. and you know, it wasn't my mom's fault. It wasn't my dad's fault. It was just the way it was. Right. So that had a profound effect on me, like, in terms of, like, my relationship with teachers, the relationship with people that I didn't know, you know? So, you know, when you're a kid and you're, like, establishing those neural pathways in your brain, and you have trauma like that, right? And trauma is such a powerful thing. You know, it's tough. It's like rolling the dice. Like, most people that are traumatized that way probably don't bounce back from it, or are able to, like, conceptualize, like, how that impacts everything they do moving forward, right? So your parents split up, I'm having that sexual abuse, I'm trying to fight in the classroom just to be normal and be considered normal, you know, and working through the, you know, figuring out how life is, you know, from wearing a hearing aid and maybe looking different. You know, I remember going to the Métis gatherings in the summer times and fighting. I'd fight the white kids, as the white kids thought I was Native, and the Native kids would beat me up because they thought I was white, right? So I was fighting everybody, right? So yeah. Learned how to fight, though, so I guess that was good. But so I mean, you know, I got to look at the bright side, right? There's always a positive side to it. But all of that stuff, like, when you're a kid, you know, those relationships that you have, however that looks, and then if you see your parents modeling a relationship a certain way, carry that, right? Those things are part of your fiber. That's the part of the fabric of your being, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm you know, when you asked me to come in here today, you're talking about mental health, and mental health was the last piece for me, really. Like, I was strong, I was able to, like, you know, interact with different situations, social settings and all that. But the mental health part of it was something that really kind of caught me off guard. You know, and I bring up the sexual abuse because that was something that came back. You know, I didn't really even think about it. And I'm going to be honest with you, Rod, I totally forgot about it. And then it wasn't until probably 2010 that I really started thinking about it again. Mm-hmm. And I had to deal with it, Rod. Like, I had to, and when you're talking about how that affects you, like, what happens when you're a kid and how that helps you or maybe in some cases hinders you in your career, I guess intuitively, even though I wasn't dealing with it and I wasn't addressing it, there was something that was driving me, and I think that's what it was. And I didn't pick this. I ended up working in a sexual issues program for 10 years out of sheer dumb luck. You know, I didn't pick it. It was just where they ended up putting me there. So you want to talk about, you know, having a plan, you know, for your life and your life taking it, just sometimes the ball bounces funny and you just end up where you were supposed to be, right? So and that was very cathartic for me. It was very therapeutic. I was able to work through a lot of my own issues by doing that, because I came to an understanding not only of, like, you know, why it happened, how it happened. I was able to learn to forgive, you know, not to be so bitter about it. My mom was just doing the best she could. She had three kids. She didn't know what to do. Like, you know, she just, like, it wasn't her fault, you know. The only person who's to blame is dead. So there's really no point in me, you know, holding on to that anymore, you know. And I'm not ashamed to say that I sought out help. I went and I saw somebody, and it wasn't just one person. It was many people. I went and I had to I had to figure it out. I had to turn these things over, and I had to do it with a person that didn't have anything emotionally invested in me, you know, someone that didn't have something riding on the outcome of our relationship. Right. So, and that's something that's the last piece for me that came in and fell into place was the mental health one. Cause it was just something that I think as athletes, we tell ourselves that, you know, we're strong and we can do these things and we're physically, we look great and everybody just, that's what they see. Right. But
yeah.
A lot of times, like, I didn't know what anxiety was until after I started talking to somebody about, like, some of these issues that happened, and anxiety was one of the byproducts, you know, and anxiety is something I still struggle with, you know. I didn't even know what anxiety was. I just thought, you know, what's nerves, right? But no, it's more than that, you know. And it gets, if you don't deal with it, if you don't address it, it doesn't get better, you know. So and I'm a work in progress, you know. I still once in a while will go in and just, you know, have somebody come in and take a hood, look under the hood, and yeah, you know, maybe you need to get things a little topped up here, and you know, so it's always good to go talk to somebody, you know, and especially if it's somebody that doesn't have anything invested in the outcome of your conversation or doesn't have any ulterior motives for being there. Sometimes you just need to get things out. And I think sometimes things have power over us because we don't speak them. You know, and we don't acknowledge them, or we don't make an attempt to try to understand why those things happen. And I think that sometimes when we do that, we're very powerfully surprised by the answers that we get. And sometimes they're not the answers we think we're going to get, you know.
Totally. Jed, one of the things that
I was going to get out of that. So
one of the things that, well, your story resonates with me a lot, because it wasn't until about 2-3 years ago that I started dealing with my demons. I dealt with the same thing for about 2-3 years. And it was from a family and their kids. And one of the things that I realized is I buried it underneath everything. And when I came to face those, I call them my demons, but when I came to face it head on, what I realized was, like, I'll give you an example. I still struggle going into public washrooms. I still struggle going into change rooms. Anything to do with just men involved is out of my comfort zone. Still to this day, we've been doing drop-in groups, men's drop-in groups for about 16 months now. And still to this day, it's still, it's like pulling teeth to get me in there some nights. Right. Mm-hmm. And it stemmed from these incidents that happened when I was 4, 5, 6 years old. And again, much like you, it wasn't my parents' fault. They had no idea, actually, until recently. For me, I knew it was a defense mechanism. But for you, what was it? What was it that kept you from even thinking about it or even forgetting about it? What was it for you that, you know, sat in the shit for a while and said, you know what, I need to face this head on?
Okay. Well, I'll be honest with you. It wasn't something I ever really thought about because I was ashamed of it. Like, I didn't want to go there. Like, I didn't let my head drift there. You know, it was a bad memory. So I didn't. And the brain is a pretty amazing thing in that, it'll allow you to do that. You know, your brain will be like, yeah, okay, that's cool. You know, let's go have a few drinks, you know, let's live and party up here, you know, let's if you don't want to think about that, let's go over here. Let's see. Hey, you're feeling pretty good there, aren't you? You know, like, let's have some conversations, you know, let's get this thing. Let's up the ante. Let's go higher. Like, you know what I mean? Let's make this thing. So, and that continues, you know, until you start to acknowledge some of the things that are, and I think what happens is you start adding all these things, and then you forget why you started doing it in the first place. And then next thing you know, you're like out of control. And I played for 13 years. My last year was in 2002. One of the big things that happened to me was when I went into therapy after my last year. Now, I've always said that every professional athlete, or any elite athlete for that matter, dies twice. First time is when they end their career. And that doesn't have to be an elite athlete. It can be just a guy that loved playing hockey, or a guy or a girl that loved being a gymnast. You know, like, it's just when you lose that and you don't have the ability to do that anymore, sometimes it can be just like losing someone, you know, someone you love very much more than anything else in the whole world. And then now what am I going to do? Right. So, you know, sometimes people have a hard time replacing that. Right. And so I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. After I got done playing in 2002, I think it was, late winter in 2003, I sat in the car in the garage in my, and I just, everything got to be too much. My grandfather died. My marriage had ended. I was married for 10 years and my wife and I split up. You know, it just wasn't, the relationship wasn't working. It wasn't anybody's fault. It was just the way it worked, right? And I ended up being kind of the, I didn't go back to Colorado where my kids were. And I had a really hard time with that because I love my kids very much. But I had to make a very difficult choice. You know, I mean, I could be there or I could, I couldn't be there because in my mind, I had made it so that I couldn't peacefully coexist with my ex-wife. Now, whether that's true or not, that's up for debate, you know, and that's just the way I approached it. And I have to live with that, you know, and then those choices affected a lot of people, you know. And then with my grandfather dying, my mom's dad, when we moved to Tennessee, he became my dad. You know, he was the one that, you know, was, took the time to teach me concepts and showed me what it was to be a man and to do the right thing, you know. It's said that sometimes, you know, the voice that you hear in your head is usually the voice of the person that you respect the most in your life. And that was my grandfather. He's the one that I hear in my head when I'm, you know, faced with the moral dilemma. I'm like, well, what would my grandfather do, right? So, and then when he died in 2002, he was 91 years old. My relationship was over. Football was over. It was hard. And I didn't have the tools to deal with it. I didn't have the resiliency. I didn't have the ability to be able to say, wait a minute, man, I need some help. I need to go see somebody, right? My answer was I'm just going to go party. I'm just going to go have a good time. I'm going to see where this takes me, right? Like, yeah, let's go to this party. Let's do this, right? And it wasn't sustainable, you know, and, you know, when you start fooling around with the chemicals in your head and, you know, it's very difficult. It's very easy to get unbalanced, you know, and make some pretty strange decisions in the heat of the moment. So thankfully that day that I chose to do that, I was in my garage, had the car running, I had a hose in the trunk. And I don't know why to this day, you know, it was the girl that I was living with at the time just happened to come home from work and she found me. So, and I've told very few people that story. And when someone asks me, so well, what do you think made you do that? And I said, well, I didn't know how to cope. I didn't know what to do, you know? So what did I need to change? Well, that was the first time I ever went to go seek therapy. And I was able to kind of put everything out on the table. And it wasn't just because of the relationship. It was because of the way I approached life. And I had to have like a heart to heart with someone and say, am I okay? You know, like sometimes I think because we spend so much time in our own heads and that's the worst place we could be, you know, because we can convince ourselves of anything, man, anything, you know, that's guy. I'm going to go pick up an 8-ball. I'm going to party for two weeks. That sounds like a great idea, right? Like nobody's saying, hey man, that's a great idea. Like it's easy, you know? But if it's just you, you're talking to, you're going to go do that. Right. So, and I'm not saying that's what I did, but you know, those are the conversations that people have in those moments. Right. So, that was my first hint that, yeah, you know, maybe you've got some things you need to think about, because, you know, when you have stressors like that, and I was moving too. So you move, someone you love dies, your relationship ends, your football career ends. So that's four. And I remember talking to my doctor about that. He's like, dude, two of those would be enough for me to refer you to a therapist. Now you've got, and I had some other things going on. And I broke my leg, right? So I was dealing with a major health, you know, so there was all these things, you know, and he was like, you need to see somebody. And if you don't, I'm going to make the decision for you. And I was like, oh no, that's good. So I did that. And that was the first time. And that was the first in a series of efforts to try to figure it out, you know, and everybody's story is different, you know, and everybody reaches those moments of clarity, so to speak. And, you know, I don't think about that very often, you know, and then when you asked me to come on tonight to talk about it, when I saw mental health, I was like, people need to talk about these things, you know, because we all show everybody our A side, you know, you remember those records that everybody used to play, those 45s, you know, it was always the A side with the hit, and the B side was just some filler, right? Some track filler, you know, we don't show people the track fillers, but you know what, let's be honest, we're all track fillers, man. We just show everybody the A side, and then the rest of our life is just track fillers, right? And some of the track fillers are pretty good, but we don't let anybody see them, you know? And so most often those things don't see the light of day. But I find that, you know, now that we're starting to normalize mental health and we're starting to approach the that part of it, because what we do physically is just like the tip of the iceberg. You know, the majority of the stuff that's happening is happening here and here, you know? So, you know, we got these weird stigmas that, you know, it's not cool to talk or ask for help or share the feelings, or, you know, you're a wimp, or, you know, you should just figure it out, you know, like suck it up. You know, that's people are dying because they're taking that approach, right? You know, and that's isolating when you hear that type of language. And the locker rooms are really, let's face it, the last sort of bastion, or the last sort of big, you know, monolithic homage to, you know, being a man, and, you know, deal with it on your own terms, and, you know, figure it out, like stop being such a pussy, right? Like, you know, people, we got to get away from that, you know, because people, I've had people, many people that I've worked, kids that I've worked with that have died because of that approach, you know? Yeah, man, things have to change.
I couldn't agree more, man. I couldn't agree more. I actually got a question. I follow you on Facebook, and I remember you wrote a story on Facebook. It was, you were feeling down about yourself because of your hearing. Mm-hmm. And your dad picked you up and drove you out, I want to say, to like Montreal or something like that, and dropped him off at your his buddy's house. I guess if you want, you could tell that story. I mean, that's a great story about resiliency and like overcoming what you think is a issue.
Yeah. So one day I was visiting my dad. I was in, I think it was about nine or 10 years old. I was in Ottawa. And it was one of the first times I'd actually seen my dad. I saw after my parents split up, and I was really mad at him, you know, and I was really mad at just life, period, because, you know, I didn't have my parents at home. I mean, I know a lot of people know what that feels like, especially now more than ever. It seems like relationships breaking down. But, you know, I was always kind of, back then, it wasn't really that normal for that to happen, right? Like, everybody's parents were together, it seemed like, and I was kind of the weird guy who had a really good-looking mom and had no husband, so something wrong, you know, right? So I was up in Ottawa visiting with my dad, and I was being really, really difficult, and wouldn't talk to him, and I was really upset about the fact that I couldn't hear, and that I had to do things differently, and I had to learn things at a different rate, and I was just tired of it, right? So I was kind of starting to shut down. And so my dad was always really good about it, and this is one of the reasons why he said, listen, you need to get out and do things. And he said, you need to go out and shut your mouth and listen and watch, right? And so this one particular morning, he woke me up early in the morning, and this was something that we used to always do. We would get up really super early, like 6 o'clock in the morning, and then he would just take me for a drive. And that was not something I ever questioned. It was just something we did. It was normal, right? I know sometimes when I posted that story, I didn't give the context for that, but that was normal for us. We would get up at 6 in the morning, and that was the way we spent time. We didn't talk, right? So we just drive, and, you know, wherever the car ended up going, that's where we would go. And so we found ourselves in Mont Tremblant, Quebec, which is probably about 1.5-2 hours away from Ottawa, probably more. But, and then he just drives up to this random cottage out in the middle of the woods, man. Like, it's just like something I'm delivering, right? And there's nothing there. It's just peace. And my dad says, okay, walk over there and knock on the door. I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, go over there and walk, knock on the door, man. They're expecting you. And I'm like, who's expecting me? He goes, you'll see. I said, what? And then he drives away. And I'm in Quebec, and I don't speak French. I can barely speak English, right?
How old were you at the time, Jack?
Nine.
No, 9 years old. This fucks off.
Your dad was an asshole, right? So, exactly. So I go over there. I don't have any choices. I don't even have options, right? I'm not going to walk back down the scary dirt road that's in, you know, like something could jump out and get me, right? So I have to get there. Think, man, this was the three, not very long after that had happened to me, right? So I was pretty jumpy, right? So I was like, all right, well, my dad told me to go over there. I'm going to trust him, you know. I wasn't happy. Like, I was really angry, right? So I went over to the door of the cabin, and I knocked on the door. Nothing. Nothing happened. So I look around, and I'm like, this is not happening to me, right? So knock on the door again. The door opened. And I don't see anything. And I'm looking at it, and then I look down, and there's this guy with no legs. I'm like, you got to be kidding me, man. My dad dropped me off so that I'd be sitting in the cabin in the middle of the woods with a guy with no legs. So, anyway, the guy with no legs looks up at me with the biggest smile, and he says, they told me you were coming over. Come on in. And I look, and about this time I realized that he had one arm that was funky. The other arm he would pull himself along the floor like super quick. Like he was really, really agile for only having one arm, right? So, and two stumps. And so he's like, hey, what do you want to do? Jay says you're going to be here for a while. So let's play some games. What? You want what? He said, I got a games room in here. Come on over here. So it was a big cabin. Like I just saw the front. The rest of it was like a walkout. So you saw the front. It looked really small, but it was actually really big. It was huge. And so we went in the back and he had this big pool table set up. And he's like, come on, let's play some pool. And I'm like, no, man. What? Really? What? You want to play pool? All right, cool. He's like, and he pulls himself up on this stool, like really fast, skitters up, and he's like sitting there. And he goes, do you mind breaking? Because, you know, and I was like, okay, I'll. Do you mind racking them up? Because, you know, I was like, okay, I'll rack them up. So I racked them up, just like my dad had showed me, whatever. And he goes, you okay if I break? I was like, yeah, sure, you know, whatever, you know. And then he broke, ran the table, didn't miss a ball. And then he's like, do you want to break next time? Because he saw the look on my face. And I'm like, dude, like, really? And he's like, yeah, but you got to rack it up and you can break it just as yourself. And so I racked it up and then he let me shoot. I didn't make anything in. And he took over and he dunked all the balls again. So it wasn't a fluke, right? He was actually a really good pool player. I'm like, damn. So he had all these games set up in this. Like he had this one was to shoot the moon. We use your finger and your thumb to make the two bars, put the marble all the way up to the top there. He was an expert at that. And there was another one where he would use his nose and his hand on this board where you'd put the marble to go through the maze that would go through the holes. So you'd avoid the, yeah, and he went all the way to the back. I could only get like two holes and it was in. So it was like 50 holes and he was a master at it. And we played games for probably a solid hour, an hour and a half, but he beat me at every single one. There was, I didn't even have a chance. Like there was no, like it was just wasn't even close, right? So I was like, wow, this guy's amazing, right? So then we get to the end of the games and he's like, well, there's nothing else to play. Let's go fishing. So, okay, let's go fishing, right? So he pulls his wife out of the kitchen and he comes in with us and she's driving the boat and he's like casting and stuff. He's like, just killing it, man. It's like, I'm like, what are you using? Right. And he won't tell me what he's using. And then finally, like reeks my, you know, my rod up and I can't even get the fish in. So he's like grabbing it, you know, I don't know, even know how he reeled that stuff in, but he was doing things like I was just in awe. Right. And then once we started kind of, you know, the ice was broken or whatever. And he started talking to me. He's like, listen, Jay told me that, you like to play football. And I was like, yeah, you know, started playing football in Tennessee and I don't want to be like my dad and stuff. And he goes, well, I met your dad playing football. You know, he used to play for the Alouettes. And I was like, really? And I didn't know anything about him. Right. And he goes, my name's Carl Hilsinger. He goes, I used to be a really good skier and I used to be a football player and I used to do a whole bunch of things. And then one day I was driving home from work and there had been a big storm and lightning had knocked down some power lines just down the road from where you guys drove in. And I got out when the power lines were in the road and I took a step and I stepped on these live power lines and blew me across the street. And I was rushed to the hospital. And when I woke up, I didn't have any legs. And not only that, but I can't use this arm, right? So I was like, wow, so what did you do? And he goes, the first thing I thought was, when can I go skiing? And that's what he asked the doctor. Doctor, when can I go skiing? And the doctor says, you'll never ski again. Like, Carl, you really have to start thinking about making these changes in your life. Like, your life's never going to be the same. And he's like, I don't think so. He says, I'm going to ski. And you watch. And sure enough, like, he was one of the first Paralympic skiers. He like won a whole bunch of gold medals in Paralympic skiing. He's a scratch golfer. Like, he uses stumps. He has stumps that he wears, but he didn't wear them that day because he wanted to make a point. Right? He wanted to show me that, you know, this is what you see, but that's not who I am, right? Mm-hmm. And he said, you know what? I made a promise to myself that I would never feel sorry for myself, because if I do that, I'm dead. I might as well not, you know, I might as well quit, right? Because if I feel sorry for myself in my state, what's left, right? You know, and I've got people that count on me, right? I get kids and wife and everything. And it's not just about me. It's about like what I can do, you know, what I can offer. He says, when we start thinking about that way, thinking like that about ourselves, that's when we're in trouble, right? Mm-hmm. And he says, so, and he was actually the first spokesman for the War Amps, you know, and I'm old, like I'm 54, but back in those days, he was the one that they would show those. Cause you know, you ever watch those Play Safe commercials where the kid kicks the ball off and CFO players are holding it? the precursor to that was Carl Hilsinger skiing down the hill on the skis and stuff like that. And I wish I could find the video, but you know, it was extraordinary guy, you know. And I remember when my dad showed up later that afternoon, I didn't put this in the story, but I didn't want to go home. Like, I wanted to stay. I asked if we could stay the night, you know. And my dad says, looks like you guys had a good time. And I looked at him. I was like, oh, wow. You know, like, wow. I said, thank you. You know, and then we just got in the car and I didn't say anything on the way home. And I just, like, things were kind of happening for me, because at that point I kind of made up my mind that, you know what, you know, I'm nine and things are pretty shitty. And, you know, like, I don't see a lot of good things happening. But then my dad was a visual guy, right? He was a guy that, you know, he could talk all he wanted, but he knew I wasn't hearing him a lot of, not only because I couldn't hear him, but because I wouldn't, you know? And he knew that maybe the message couldn't come from him in that moment. It had to come from somebody else. And it had come from someone that was where the message would be received, right? And that's different for everybody, you know? And in that moment, when I needed it the most, that's the way my dad was able to reach out to me. There were a lot of things my dad wasn't, but there were a lot of things he was, you know, and that was one of those moments where he showed me that. So
that's a great story. I love that story. Yeah, I read that on your Facebook and I was like, I got to hear this story. Cause like,
yeah. And you know what? He gave me a Alouette sideline jacket that day. He said, I want you to have this, and I have it and I wear it. And I actually wore it one day. I wasn't really even thinking about the story behind it. I got to tell you, Rod, I forgot about that. I'd forgotten about it. It wasn't until my dad was dying and that story came out again. And it was my dad telling it. And I had totally forgotten that story. And then my dad, they wrote an article in the Ottawa Citizen back home when my dad was in the, you know, dying, you know, in his deathbed. And he told that story again. And I had totally forgotten it, you know, and it wasn't maybe a couple of weeks after that I forgot all about it. I remember having that jacket, but I couldn't remember where I got it from. Right. Mm-hmm. And so he told that story and I was like, and I just started crying. And I was like, oh my God, like, wow. Like, what a gift. Right. And so that's part of being a dad, right? And that's part of being a mentor. And that's part of being someone who, you know, like Joe Cardinal did that day when he was telling us about what he went through in Bastogne, when he, you know, the world is a better place than that. You know what I mean? And there's so many terrible things that are going on around us and within us, you know, we owe it to one another to look out for each other, you know, and sometimes the messages have to be delivered in a way that's only received by the person it's intended for. Right. And in that moment, that was me, you know, and I'm sure you guys have had plenty of situations or scenarios where people were that for you as well.
Yeah. That's a beautiful story, man. Listen, Jed, we're coming up on an hour here. I could spend all night talking to you, man. It's you know, when Rod told me that he knew you, I was like, well, first of all, get the fuck out of town. Like, that's that's crazy that you know them. And the fact that, you know, you were, you know, we're very grateful that you came on our podcast and have this conversation. You know, that's the one thing I wanted to talk to you about was the mental health and you know, being a retired athlete. You know, I was on the cusp. I was this close to becoming a professional bodybuilder and I walked away from it for health and family purposes. And so I know exactly what you mean. And it was like, for me, it was, almost like a void. It was like, it was like a dark.
Well, I mean, it becomes who you are, you know, and when you give that up, it's hard, man. You know, like, don't let anybody try to BS you, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, everything that we talked about tonight regarding your childhood, you know, the adversities that you went through, the lessons you learned, I think that, you know, our listeners are going to really enjoy this episode. Yeah. So thank you very much for doing this tonight. Rod, any closing thoughts and remarks?
Yeah. For all our listeners out there with the subject, I guess, and what we were talking about tonight, it reminded me of a TV show, 911. If anyone's seen it, it's got like Jennifer Love Hewitt and some other people in it, I guess. But the captain for the fire department, Bobby, he has this monologue at the end of season 4, episode 14. And it's, I was looking at it on my phone and I found it. And it says, Carl Sagan said, extinction is the rule. Survival is the expectation. When the world feels like a never ending emergency, sometimes just making it through the day can be a struggle. We collect scars, physical and psychological, reminders of what we've been through, of who and what we've lost. But maybe those scars can do more than memorialize our past traumas. Maybe they're also a testament to the fact that we're still here. We are exceptional. We are survivors. That's for like your story with your hearing disability and what you went through, what men go through, and we're ashamed and we're told no one would believe us. I mean that I heard that monologue like 2 days, 3 days ago or something like that, when I was taking a little me time from schoolwork, and tears came into my eyes. I'm like, holy fuck. Mm-hmm. Like that hit hard. I know since I've dealt with my demons, I'm more emotionally attached to myself than I ever was before. Like I can watch something on TV and my eyes will start watering up, hearing stuff on the news, like not like any of the stuff that's going on now, but like our good felt heartwarming stories are like, hell yeah, there's still humanity.
Oh yeah. I'm a blubber face that way.
Yeah. It's just those types of things. And I've realized that I started doing that more when I started dealing with my shit past, I guess, than the traumas that I dealt with growing up and traumas that I buried and tried to cover it up with drugs, alcohol, women. Yeah. It was just that, I guess, like you said, it was just that time, that aha moment. Right. Yeah. I know David Restoul, we've had him on the podcast. And when we were doing a talking circle for our last of our class, he said, generations before we even came onto the land, the creator let us choose our parents. Yeah. How everyone says our parents chose us. Well, he said the indigenous way of thinking of it, which actually I was going to
the other way around.
Yeah. Generations before we were in a thought in our parents, we picked our parents, we picked our path, we picked our traumas. Mm-hmm. So, because we knew, and because we picked our life path with the creator. So he knows what we can deal with. So everything that was put in our path was just like that monologue said, is our testament to who we are.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful, man. That's beautiful. Jed, thanks a lot for doing this, man. I'm going to keep you on the line. I'm just going to stop the recording here. Thanks again for doing this. Jed, where can our listeners find you first and foremost?
Well, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, actually, which I kind of started using a little bit more than I used to.
Yeah, you talk a lot of football, man.
Yeah, and then I'm on Instagram. So those are the three social media outlets. And I've been kind of putting out some vignettes out here and there. It's something that my wife's been on me about. Like, you should, you know, and I, Rod, when you were saying, like, I resonate with that when you're talking about, like, I get emotional and I think about, you know what, you're paying attention. Paying attention, man. Like, mm-hmm. when you start to pay attention, you start to see these things, right? And you start to, and you allow yourself to feel it, you know, and that's the purest form of living, you know, and that's the way we were intended to be. You know, we weren't intended to be like these big, strong, tough guys that act like assholes. We were intended to be emotional, and we're intended to be connected to what's going on around us. And we're intended to be healers, you know, and people that can speak to like those things when they happen in the moment and share those thoughts. Right. So good on you for doing that. But yeah, man, you know, you guys are on the right track. You know, I love the fact that you guys are talking about these issues. These are important. And you know what? Life is lived. You know, a lot of life is lived in that sort of, like, people call it like being boring and having a boring night and having popcorn or whatever. Man, that's the best night I can think of, you know, when you're just hanging out and you're talking about something. You know, my wife and I, we've been together for 15 years, and we've just had one long conversation. You know what I mean? And that's what it's about. You know, find somebody that you can spend time with, that you can have one long conversation. Just pick up right where you left off. And if you have good friends, you guys know what I'm talking about, right? So use your network. Lean on those people. You know, they want to help you. Don't allow yourself to talk yourself out of that, you know, because that's where we run into trouble, is we convince ourselves that we don't have any other options. We always have options. Yeah. We always have people that care about us. We just have to be willing to let them in, you know.
Amen to that, man.
Thanks for having me. It was really nice to be able to. I needed this as much as you guys said you really enjoyed this. This is something I need to do. Like, I need to. This is part of my therapy, is to just get in and just be honest and be real. And just talk about, you know, how I feel about certain things. And, you know, 30 years ago, I would have never said any of that. I would have just been, you know, too proud or too scared or whatever. You know, put an adjective in there. That's what I would have been, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you get older, you let a lot of that stuff go. And, you know, I've still got a lot to learn, you know, and one of the reasons why I do these things is because I get to hear stories. Like, you know, I did bodybuilding, and that's not, I lift weights every day, you know, I totally get that. Like,
yeah, I had a question for you. How big were you in your heyday?
Well, I wasn't I was 290. My last year was 293. But I was 6'2", really 6'3"? 6'2", 6'3", about 293, but I came in at 230. So I just sort of got bigger and bigger, right? My last year I was benching 550. So it's pretty strong, right?
Truck, man. I love it, dude. So
pretty strong, right? And I can still incline about 385. So I'm pretty strong. Like, old man strength is a real thing.
Exactly, man. Exactly. I had to ask. All right, man. Thank you so much for doing this, Jed. Thanks, I'm going to keep you on the line here.